comedy alive from Gary Smulehan's house. I'm Johannes Stauffer, and with me as always is room upon room of Thomas the Tank Engine memorabilia. And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 9.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We're so good to have you here at the Mildly Alarming Podcast, the only show on the internet. I'm Tom Rich.
And I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And it's the Mildly Alarming Podcast that we are doing right now, and we're happy to have you. Aren't we, Johannes?
So happy.
You don't seem happy.
Do I ever?
No, no. Okay. I don't think you know what happiness really is.
Glad we had this talk.
It's a good talk. It's a good talk, and it's a good day, and it's a good podcast. What's on the topic for tonight?
What's on the topic for tonight?
Listen, let's not get stuck on minutia. Focus. The last episode wandered a bit. We need to stay on target.
It was real bad.
We need to just Jack Porkins this business.
They called the fat guy Porkins.
And stay on target. Stay on target.
I believe we're talking about hidden information.
How much information do you have available?
What? Terrible podcast.
Terrible podcast. Now, so hidden information, we're talking tonight about it. How it's used in games, how much info you present to the players, how much you keep secret, who knows what, when, and how, and why, and how that impacts your design process, your play process, your amusements, your enjoyment, and your 401k. So, let's get started with it. What do you think about hidden information?
You have a 401k?
Probably.
Wow.
Isn't that what happens when you get a job? Isn't that how that works?
A good job, I guess.
Oh, okay. Actually, we're focusing. No, we're not going to tangent. We're focusing.
Okay. Hidden information, then.
Hidden information.
We're hiding the information you were about to share.
The story I was about to tell is hidden information that other players of this game now do not have. Hidden information, a classic example of it, you're playing poker? Is that how that's pronounced?
Poker.
Poker. You're playing poker with some other players, and you don't know what's in their hands, because all you can see are the backs of the cards, which cleverly, and this is a brilliant design feature by the designers of poker, all of the cards have the same back, so you can't tell which one it is based on the back. And so that's hidden information. You don't know what's in they hands. I did some gestures with that bit. And so that impacts your decision-making process. You can't make a decision based on any kind of knowledge there. You have to eliminate what's in your hand, what you know is not in their hand, that is, and then run the odds on what's probably in their hand, but might not be. You don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't have that info. A counterexample to that would be a game like Monopoly, and I use the word game loosely there, where there's nothing hidden there. You know, you could conceivably count the other player's money. You can see what properties they own, how many houses and hotels they've built, whether they're the dog or the shoe. You can see the life draining from their eyes, so that's not really hidden info. The only thing that's hidden is what they're planning to do, which isn't really hidden, because what they're going to do is roll the dice and then go to where they rolled, and then they'll spend whatever money is required at that place. It's a terrible freaking game.
I have played so little Monopoly, I don't even understand some things that some people hate about Monopoly, because
mm-hmm.
I understood so quickly that I hated it, that I was just like, no, I'm not playing this game.
It's not good.
No. What's the thing with putting money on free parking?
So that's not actually like a...
It's a house rule.
It's a house rule, yeah. So there are certain things that'll make you pay money, like the luxury tax space. You pay like $75. Some of the cards will make you pay money.
Uh-huh.
And by the base rules, that just goes back to the bank.
Right, that makes sense.
But by the house rule, all of that money goes into the middle of the board. And then if you land on free parking, which is one of the corner spaces, you just get you get to grab it.
And it's like you won the lottery.
Yeah, you get it. It's all in your money. Except, why does free parking give you that
it's
money?
The only good thing that happens in the game, probably.
Pretty much, yeah. So that's the free parking rule.
It seems like it would just drag a game out further.
I don't understand having strong opinions about Monopoly other than this is not quality. Why am I playing it?
Right.
But
I actually read an interesting article about how Monopoly copies of Monopoly were used to get maps or something to.
I think I've heard of this. Yeah,
soldiers who were in POW camps in one of the world wars.
Uh huh.
Like they were required to allow a certain level of comfort be provided to prisoners of war. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. or Britain or someone shipped like care packages basically to them, including games of Monopoly that like. If you split the cardboard of the board in half or something, mm-hmm. had like maps and stuff in it. So that's a good use of Monopoly. Well, so perhaps the only good use of Monopoly.
Perhaps. That illustrates two points, though, in that one, games are good because they can provide succor and hope to a suffering person.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure I used succor correctly there, but we'll move on. And second, Monopoly works as the game that you ship to your POWs because it's such a universal game, everybody gets it. Like, you can't send a copy of Dominion to a POW. Like, that's just not going to work.
I thought you were going to say Monopoly is so universally reviled that even the Nazis would allow their prisoners of war to have it. Because it's clearly not providing anything but punishment.
That would have been funnier.
Yeah.
If I was a good podcast host, I would have gone there. But we're focusing tonight on hidden information. So I guess my question for you at this point is, what amount of hidden information seems appropriate? Do you feel like you want a lot of hidden information that you need to balance in your head? Do you feel like you want minimal? Like, I know you don't like Euros, which tend to minimize stuff like hidden info and luck and chance and whatnot. How much is too much? Is there not too much? What do you think about that?
It depends so much on the game that it's hard to answer quickly. Mm-hmm. Like, so if you use a game like poker as your example, that game required poker,
yeah.
Requires hidden information, and it wouldn't work otherwise. You couldn't really play it with an open hand, and so in that context, even bothering to call it hidden information seems stupid. But if you want to go to the other end of the spectrum, a cooperative game where you want to be able to share information with one another, but you're not allowed to because the rules of the game require hidden information, mm-hmm. at least to some degree. Maybe you can mm-hmm. communicate it, but you can't say, I have these cards in my hand. Or like you can even say, I have these cards, but you can't show them. It's a completely different way of interacting with hidden information as a game mechanic. So we've seen that used in, what's it called? Space Alert, where you're programming and you're all trying to work together to run a ship, but you can't show each other what cards you have in hand. You can only say it, but you're on a time crunch, so you don't want to. That's interesting. I see the point you were making about Euros. I've never really bothered to think about it that way before, but a competitive game where all of the information is out there makes it so that you need to be able to kind of keep everyone's status in your head,
right,
in order to compete with them. You also, I guess they need to be able to as well, so you have to assume that they're able to memorize not only their own status and how they plan to advance, but also your status and the status mm-hmm. of any other players. But it's just, yeah, that's part of what I don't like about those sorts of games. I don't have the headspace for that, and even if I did, I don't think I would find it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think I feel similarly about that as I feel about like what I would call a poorly designed games that use motor skills. Dexterity game. Like, there's a point where you just can't do that. You just don't have the dexterity. Mm-hmm. And, like, most of those tend to be designed for kids or designed to be, like, party gamey, so it's not that big a deal. But, like, there's a point at which someone just has inherently better hand-eye coordination than other people, and they're going to win all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point at which someone, their brain is wired in such a way that a game with no hidden information is just going to be easier for them than other people. So they're just going to win all the time. And that's fine if you're at chess, you know, chess master levels of competition with other people on that level. But if you're just playing board games with your friends on the weekend,
mm-hmm.
they're not going to want to play that game with you after the first or second time.
Right. It's not fun to be the whipping boy.
So hidden information is kind of evening the playing field. But I think it also adds elements of skill and of decision making, which is what you want in a game to make it engaging. Even in games, excuse me, even in games where it's not strictly necessary. So it's not as schlocky as saying, well, we need some randomness in this game, so we're going to add dice rolls or whatever mm-hmm. that we don't really need. We just wanted to try to level the playing field. It's a little more interesting because you can still try to keep it in your head. You can still try to think around it
mm-hmm.
a little bit. I don't know. I'm rambling now.
No, did that, makes sense? Yeah. I think an interesting example, too, with you were kind of talking about strategy and whatnot and the hidden information, how everything's out in front of you. Eclipse kind of runs into that a little bit too, in that everything about your actually, no, I'm wrong. I'm barking up a bad tree. Everything about your every player is available to you. You can see their resources and whatnot right out in front of you,
mm-hmm.
but there's sort of communal hidden information in the bags of chips and the
yeah.
text, but that's not really hidden info. That's a different kind of animal.
Yeah. It's a little different.
Yeah. Another game that I don't think I've only played once or twice. And I don't know that you and I have ever played is called that does a cool thing with hidden info is Hanabi.
I've never even heard of it.
It's a game about making the best fireworks show.
That sounds awesome.
It is. But it does a really cool thing in that I don't remember exactly how it works mechanically, but you need to play cards from your hand on your turn, but you don't know the cards that are in your hand. You're holding the hand with the faces away from you. So everybody, you know, I know what you have and what Alphonse has and what Gary has, but I have no idea what I have. And so on my turn, I have to ask questions to try to figure out which card I should play. And there's some rules in the book about exactly what kind of questions you can and can't ask.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of reverses the traditional hand of cards hidden info mechanic, which is kind of cool. I remember it being a lot of fun.
We played a game this weekend called Bonanza, which has been around for quite a while.
It is the best bean farming game I've ever played.
I was going to avoid making that comment, but okay.
I will never avoid making that comment.
I know. You're the worst.
Devin made that comment multiple times with glee
indeed,
in his eyes.
Indeed. But it is a game with hidden information. You have a hand of cards. You're farming beans, and you have different plots, and you're trying to line up because you can't harvest a bean field until you have a certain number of beans mm-hmm. in it, and they're only worth money rather at a certain number of beans, and so you're sort of competing with one another, but you're also bartering with one another for beans because maybe you have a blue bean field but this other guy has a red bean field and he wants your red beans but has a blue bean. Anyway, without going too much into it, there's hidden information, but it doesn't really need to be hidden. At least not at the level we were playing. I imagine you could get really good at the game
uh-huh.
and then want your information hidden. But where we were playing it, because what it does that's interesting is you have a hand of cards, but you have to play them, or you have to plant them anyway, in the order that they're in your hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that mechanic.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting. So you have this hand of cards that you're keeping secret, because I'm sure at some level of gameplay there are people who can like kind of figure out who has what and what order they're going to have to play it in and try to somehow barter things away from other mm-hmm. players that would have helped that mm-hmm. player or what, but like you'd have to be pretty functioning at a pretty high level in the game, I think, to get there. So the hidden information is almost just like add a level of feeling like you're competing with other people.
Or it's almost to the point of, well, I'm giving you a hand of cards. That's what you do with a hand of cards. You hold it in front
of
you
and
don't let other people see it.
We could have played that game open hand. It would have been like, because we didn't get, there's no rule saying like if you make a trade, you have to play the cards to one another face down.
Yeah.
So you couldn't be like, I'll give you three red beans for your blue bean and then actually give them like two wax beans in it.
Yeah. Oh, that would be That would be terrible.
Wouldn't that game get crazy? Yeah.
Or, but too, even if you play it open-handed with just your line of beans, you have to plant in front of you, then the game moves to a... It changes the dynamic of the negotiations, because now I'm saying to you, look. You've got to play your red bean this turn, and then you've got that blue bean stacked up behind it, so I can get that blue bean out of there for you by giving you this bean, you know, if you give me the blue.
Mm-hmm.
So now I can start directly pointing out what you can do and kind of manipulate you that way with specific concrete proposals. So it I don't think you actually lose anything from negotiation in that game by making it open face. You just change the way the negotiations are going to look.
Open face is a sandwich. I think open hand is...
I'm going to call it open face because I want a freaking sandwich, man.
Sandwiches are delicious.
I like sandwiches. I had a good grilled cheese last night.
I had pork. It wasn't a sandwich at all.
Was it grilled?
It was crock potted. My grill is still broken, so I can't cook anything
that
requires any finesse.
I'm not wild about crock potted pork. I always feel like it gets kind of just soggy and collapsy and just not fun.
Oh, it was great. I thought it was awesome.
Well, I could be wrong. Maybe your pork was good.
My pork is great. So, what kind of games use hidden information in a way that you think is lame? Like, they didn't need to do that there. They just kind of shoehorned it in.
Let's see here. A lot of strategy games have to have it, or they don't work. Mm-hmm. They're just nonsense. You know, I'm drawing a blank on anything where I feel like it. I guess I don't really think about whether or not info needs to be hidden.
Mm-hmm.
Off the top of my head a lot, because like in our designs, it's pretty intuitive generally what has to be secret and what doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, the hand of cards, it wouldn't make sense to have those revealed. Yeah, I'm not thinking of anything immediately.
I can't think of any either.
Yeah. I like games that when they have hidden information that explicitly call out stuff like you can say what's in your hand, but you can never show it.
Yeah.
That make that point that, no, this is truly hidden. I like that. I think that's an important distinction to make.
Because
if you're allowed to show your hand, that makes alliances different than if you have to say what's in your hand and then the other guy just has to trust you.
Right.
I like, too, when they even get more granular and say things like, you can give qualitative descriptions of your hand. Like, you can say, I can do a pretty big turn, but not a huge turn.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't give numerical quantitative descriptions about what's in your hand or you know, tell the colors of the cards or whatever.
What have we played that's like that? I have distinct memories of being like, I can put some stuff toward that.
But not, Dead of Winter, I think, had it.
Oh, yeah. Dead of Winter, you really don't want to show your hand anyway.
Right, right.
I don't remember if it was explicitly said you can't.
Actually, I think we did at several points explicitly state how many fuel we were able to dump in and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I'm wondering if it's Galaxy... what is it? The one that I like.
Galaxy Trucker?
No. Though that one's also good, too. But no, you wouldn't need it in that. I love this game. Why can't I think of what it's called? Spaceships.
Space Alert?
Nope. It's competitive, but you're not forced to fight one another. You have little plastic flying saucers.
Oh, Cosmic. Cosmic Encounter.
Cosmic Encounter. Is that the one where you can be like, I can put, you know, I can...
I don't know that you're explicitly forbidden from saying how many you have, how many points you're going to throw out
there. There's something we've played where that is the case. They're like, I can do something, but not a ton.
I wonder if it was Battlestar Galactica.
No, because we didn't play that enough for me to
to remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember.
I don't know either. It's got to be riveting. Just riveting broadcast for people to listen to right now.
It's really avant-garde. That's what's going on here.
Yeah.
It's art. It's art what's happening here. And if you don't get it, you're a Philistine.
It turns out Philistia did not have art. There just was no art.
There's none. It was just...
They just fought
and
the Israelites, I guess.
And actually, there's an interesting story about a king of Philistia who felt that a particular building that had been constructed, it was a warehouse that he was going to keep unsanded boards in.
Sure, yeah.
Had been constructed in too artistic of a fashion. It wasn't enough of a block of stone. And he had the artist launched out of a catapult. Artist. Architect, builder, guy, dude,
wow,
man.
It really fell apart on you there, didn't it?
It collapsed in ruin.
Yep.
It's been a long day.
Yeah. I wish you had hidden that information. I feel bad about that joke. That was terrible. That wasn't even good as an intentionally bad joke.
yep. Hidden information games.
What are some good ones?
Let's see here.
He said, deliberately trying to make this segment meet its time. I mean, they're the obvious ones because it's absolutely necessary. But I think they use it well, building an entire game on hiding information.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something what he said, like bluffing, or as we like to call it, lying to one another about what you have in your hand,
mm-hmm.
makes hidden information more interesting. So putting the players in a situation where being like, I might have the captain in coup,
mm-hmm.
is more interesting than just being like, I can't tell you what my cards are. Mm-hmm. And same. So Resistance does a really good job. Like, you know, if you're a spy,
mm-hmm.
no one else does. You can't show them. You can't be like, look, I'm not a spy. You have to uh-huh. convince people. Same way. That was the one we played on Saturday. Bang the Dice game.
Yeah.
You've got a sheriff who's the only one without hidden information. Everyone knows who the sheriff is. Two deputies, but they can't prove that they're deputies.
Mm-hmm.
And like, well, depending on the number.
Yeah.
A number of deputies, a number of outlaws who are trying to kill the sheriff.
And then the renegades
who
want...
And then the renegades who are the worst
they want,
to be.
They want everybody else... They want...
They have to be last man
they
standing.
They have to be last man standing. So they have to make sure they kill the outlaws and deputies and then the sheriff.
Right.
And then each other.
Yep.
Yeah. It's fantastic. But you can't prove any of this. So you just have to kind of hope you're able to puzzle it out.
That's where hidden information gets interesting to me.
But that does a really cool thing, too, with it, because not only is there hidden info, but occasionally somebody just has to make a move that is nonsense. And
right.
you're like, I have no... They're just forced... you shoot me, and I'm like, well, your dice came up that way. Maybe you're happy about it. Maybe you're happy because you like to see me lose at games.
Yeah.
Maybe you're secretly screaming inside because it's the worst possible thing for you right now. I don't know. And that's fun.
Yep.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I like hidden information games too, like that, where there are multiple reasons. It kind of spreads out multiple threads that could lead to what the player is doing. Like, one of the things that the Resistance does that may or may not, that doesn't fit this, is that it's strictly based on the number of players who go on a given mission, whether or not the mission succeeds or fails. You know, one spy fails it. I would almost like to see, like, where you have and this would be a different game at this point, where you have a hand of, like, mission cards you could play that would add a value to the mission. You have to total up to a certain value, and the spies are playing negative numbers or whatever. And so you might be saying, no, don't send me on that mission, not because I'm not a spy, but because I just don't have the numbers to help with it right now. So where there's a legitimate, you spread out those multiple layers of confusion and paranoia among the players.
I think it would make it too hard to play. It would need to be a little more complex than.
Yeah, yeah.
Than the Resistance is, because the Resistance, it's already hard enough to figure out who is good and who is bad when it's clear that at least someone sabotaged the mission deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
So it would make for a longer game, but it's pretty interesting. You've basically taken the basic mechanic of Resistance and taken a little more
granularity.
Sure. Mechanic that does a similar thing, like the resource pile in Dead of Winter,
mm-hmm.
where people can, you know, you need to get 5 fuel or whatever, but anyone who plays something into it that isn't fuel not only didn't count toward it, but actually counted negative, like away
right.
from it. But you don't know who did what when. Like, that's a little... So you're going even a little more granular than that. It could be interesting. It could mm-hmm. work.
Could be fun.
I think it would make for a longer game.
It would run the risk of getting to the point where you've hidden so much information and there's so much cloak and dagger crap going on that you are effectively rolling the dice.
Yeah, you just can't know anything.
Yeah, that's kind of the balance with hidden info stuff. Mm-hmm. How much you need to hit that point where there's enough confusion that players feel like they're solving the puzzle and navigating these murky waters mm-hmm. of the game, but not so much hidden that they're not just, you know, tying a blindfold on their face and sprinting through a dark forest, hoping they don't run into a tree. They hit a tree, that's what happens in that situation.
Yeah.
They plow into it face first.
Well, right, it's that thing, you don't just... Decision-making isn't what makes a game interesting, it's meaningful decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have to make a decision, but you are not provided with the information for that... It's like making that first move in a big enough game of Bang the Dice game. you just don't have enough information. And so it's not really interesting to be like, well, I guess I shoot you, because mm-hmm. you don't know if they're a deputy or an outlaw, or if they're on your team or if they're not.
Right.
But someone just has to do it sometimes.
Yeah.
So you would run into a lot more of that if you went any more complex with that kind of mechanic, mm-hmm. probably, which could be a problem.
It could be, or it could not be.
Maybe
I never
why
know.
They didn't do it that way. Who knows?
Might be.
So another game that we've played recently that uses hidden information, it's really bluffing, but you can't really bluff without hidden information, is Smoke and Mirrors, which is a game that's available right now, print on demand, and I'll try to remember to put a link to it in the show notes. But it's made designed by Chip Beauvais, who we actually have an interview with him coming up in a couple weeks on the show. We recorded it last week, and he's got a Kickstarter for this game and two other games. They're all releasing together in this wallet game series. They're all small little card games that fit in a wallet, mm-hmm. which is a pretty cool concept in and of itself. And you'll hear about that more.
He also has a toddler or child who gurgles adorably in the background of the interview.
That is true. Yeah, hopefully you'll be able to hear the gurgling. But his game, Smoke and Mirrors, is a fairly simplistic bluffing game. It's somewhere between Skull or Skulls and Roses. There's a few different names for that game, and Coup. In that, you've got a hand of three cards, and there's a way to sort of figure out what those cards are for other players, but it's all hidden information, and you're bluffing against one another to be like, I played cards that are worth this amount, and they just have to figure out if you did or not. Or call your bluff, and basically the whole game is distilled down to how successfully can you bluff. If someone calls your bluff, if you bluff and someone calls it, you're out. If you're not bluffing and someone calls it, they're out.
Mm-hmm.
Last man standing, first four rounds wins. Pretty straightforward, but a lot of fun. We had a good time with it.
We had a good time chatting with Chip,
too. We had a good time talking to Chip, so you should look forward to hearing that.
That's marketing we just did. That's marketing.
We marketed.
We're putting out the hook, baiting it, and just leave it in front of your mouth.
You have to bait the hook before you put it out. Otherwise, it's all the way out there, and you're still holding like a worm or whatever.
But then you just go to the hook and you bait it.
You swim out there.
Yeah.
You leave your... Okay.
And then,
No wonder you don't like fishing.
you get all wet every time. It's terrible.
So if you have anything you would like to tell us about hidden information or how Tom should learn how to fish correctly, you can hit us up on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
You can send us an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
You could leave a comment on the website at www.mildlyalarming.com.
Or you could pierce your comment on a hook and throw it into the water and I will bite down on it, and then you'll have to pull me bodily into your boat with a fishing rod.
Or if you do it Tom's way, you could cast a hook out there, swim out to it, and then put your comment on the hook and swim back, and then wait for Tom to bite down on it.
It'll work either way.
Yeah, Tom's not a very smart fish.
Brilliant fish.
We'll be right back after this word from our sponsor.
Bloop.
Your health is important to you, and your money is important to us. I'm Wayne Crothman. When I founded the Crothman Hospital and Health System, I had one goal in mind: undercutting area hospitals and diverting untold millions into my secret Swiss bank accounts. But we don't just provide the leanest, cheapest care for the highest possible price. We're also dedicated to inconveniencing you. That's why the Crothman Hospital and Health System invested $11 million to resurrect an electronic medical record system that failed in the 1970s, along with the archaic technology and obsolete software to run it, and installed it in all of our locations. It's slow, it's frustrating, and it makes life a living hell for our staff. And that's the Crothman difference. While we're harming you, we're also harming our employees. The Crothman Hospital and Health System. You won't get better, but I'll get richer.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. We're good friends. The podcast
is never going to end.
Welcome back, everybody. Glad to have you.
Good Lord.
The look on his face is so worth it. So worth it.
One day I will kill you in your sleep.
I know. And okay. I've mentally prepared myself for that.
Yeah, just mentally, not physically.
I don't know that there's really any way to physically prepare myself for that level of sea turtle assault.
What?
I assumed you were going to beat me to death with a sea turtle.
Yeah.
I mean, Gary keeps leaving all of them at your house.
I know, they're everywhere.
So many sea turtles.
You call the exterminator and they're like, "Sir, we don't deal with sea turtles."
And you're like, "Could you make an exception? I'm sure if you hit them with a big enough club, it'll be fine."
I'm not telling you to kill them. Live trap them. Just get them out of my basement.
Well, your basement does flood a lot, so it's an ideal.
Yeah, it's true. They like that moist environment.
Yeah, an ideal sea turtle sanctuary.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of salt down there. Why do you have so much salt?
Water softener.
Oh, that was like a good answer, actually.
Yeah, I know.
I was hoping you'd go somewhere funny with it.
I thought that was funny because it was unexpected.
Oh, right. It's like, you know, it's you set up for something ridiculous and you just say the normal thing.
It's like an anti-joke or not an anti-joke.
It's like if you do the how many black guys does it take to screw in a light bulb joke, and then you punchline it with just the one. Probably just the one. I think one guy can handle that. It's an easy job.
Wow.
Where did you think I was going to go with this? It's an anti-joke. You set up.
Yeah, uh-huh. No, okay, let's move on.
They expect something horrible, and then...
Just like to say goodbye to, you know, 60, 70% of our listenership.
We already alienated 90% of them in the first episode.
I know, but this is 60 or 70% of whoever was left.
So what, like, Rick's arm is going to do still listen?
Yep.
Do we use his name on the podcast? I can't remember.
We have now.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we do.
What, was that over the line?
I don't know
either. We'll find out.
Let's not keep talking about it.
All right, cool.
We'll inevitably go there.
What was the second segment for tonight?
Why do you keep asking me these things? I'm the one with ADHD. You need to remember one thing at least.
Because it's funny when you forget stuff. And in this episode, Tom demonstrates exactly what kind of person he is.
We were going to do Uva's dopamine cycle.
The dopamine cycle. So when we were at Protospiel a couple of weeks ago, we met a man named Uva, who is the king of Academy Games. I think king is the correct title, right?
I think he prefers God Emperor, but king works
something
too.
Like that, yeah. We met him and his heir, and we were chatting with him, and Uva described an idea that they use in their design process, which we found intriguing, and so we thought we'd talk about it here. And that is the idea of the dopamine cycle. So in the way Uva explained it to us was that imagine that you are a person sitting on a hill somewhere, and that you've become hungry. You have hunger in your gutular region, and you see in the distance a tree full of apples. And so you get up, and you go to the tree, and you pick an apple and you eat it. And so, his basic thought is that the thing that motivates you to do all this is dopamine, this chemical in your brain that is spewed out and sprayed willy nilly and higgledy piggledy all over the place. And
both of those.
Yeah, both. And it makes you happy. And his question was, where does the dopamine release in here? And his thought is a lot of people will expect that it's released when you take that big, juicy, fat bite of the apple and it's all delicious and crisp. And he's like, no, that's not actually where it releases, though. It starts right before you even get up when you spot the apple, because it gives you the motivation to get off your butt and go pick it. And then it ramps up as you make your way toward there, as you anticipate eating the apple, and it stops when you eat, because now you don't need it anymore to make you do stuff. It's no longer necessary. So your brain's like, switch it off. We've only got so much dopamine in the tank. Do you have any idea how much that costs? Do you have stock in the dopamine company? I'm not paying to dopamine the entire neighborhood. Close the window.
Kind of got away from you, I think.
Whatever. And so that's his thought. His thinking in designing a game is, I want to find that dopamine cycle, that cycle of make a plan, which is go eat the apple, anticipate and execute the plan, which is getting toward it, you know, working your way toward the apple, and then resolve the eating of the apple. Planning, anticipation, resolution. He wants to shorten that dopamine cycle up quite a bit and kind of focus in on that as your thing in the game. That plan it, anticipate the resolution, and then actually resolve it cycle, and then get that started again and keep it going over and over again to keep the player interested, to keep the player having fun, to keep the player engaged, and in a bit of a creepy turn, to keep the player straight up addicted. He described as wanting his game, in one interview, as wanting his games to be the PCP of the board gaming world. So we found that mildly alarming.
Mildly.
But So what do you think about the dopamine cycle and Uwe's thoughts on it? I think that's a reasonable summary I gave there.
Yep. I think it's an interesting concept. I actually have questions physiologically about whether or not that's actually how dopamine works. Because there are certainly experiences that one has that cause dopamine to be released, which is how you can become addicted to otherwise non-addictive substances or mm-hmm. actions, how you can become addicted to food. It's how you can become addicted to pornography. So the idea that the completion of whatever it is where the dopamine stops being released is weird to me. He may be right. But
well, it fits with addiction narratives, and I don't do heroin, so I'm not, you know, intimately familiar with this stuff, but where you take the hit and you get the thing, but then it gets harder and harder over time to get to the same
mm-hmm.
level because you keep hitting that drop off point. Maybe not, though. I don't know. That might be wrong.
Well, on the other hand, we don't need to keep digging into the science of it unless we're going to pull it up and actually figure it out. But it does kind of make sense that once the dopamine gets you there, and then once you have reached the thing that makes you happy, the drug or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
you don't need the dopamine anymore. I don't know. Anyway, but I think the theory behind it is sound. Mm-hmm. That there are cycles in gameplay that are what players enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to make it so that those cycles happen quickly and repeatedly at a high, that he calls a high amplitude. You're getting a lot of satisfaction out of the game
mm-hmm.
Quickly and regularly, rather than slowly, slowly, painfully building toward it once
mm-hmm.
per round or whatever. I think that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And given what he's talked about a little bit, Uwe designs war games, largely historical war game, Euro-y style games, but that seem to, in a lot of instances, sort of defy convention for Euro games and war games, in that they're not quite so fiddly, they're not so many rules and long drawn mm-hmm. out movements of resources, and like you're still moving resources and doing stuff, but it's not I memorized this rule book and now I'm good at this game. It's we've designed a game that gives you a lot of meaningful decisions that are gratifying to complete and interesting to track, and so you want to keep doing mm-hmm. it. And so whether that game was skinned as, you know, the American Civil War or orcs versus whatever, the mechanics are what drives the enjoyment of the game
mm-hmm.
because they've put so much thought into making sure it is enjoyable mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting.
Yeah, that's a good idea. It makes sense to me.
He made some good points when we were playing. This is when he gave us the whole kind of dopamine cycle spiel at Proto Spiel. Was when we were playing David Spitzley's game, that big
Invisible Hands.
Invisible Hands. Yeah. It looked like Risk. It was a giant globe map, kind of strategic. Mm-hmm. He was talking to him about, like, too many of the things that you're building toward as a player take a little too long right now to achieve. And so the players have to take several turns before they get to the point where they can do something where mm-hmm. they're like, yes, I've accomplished something. This is what I mean to do in this game.
Right.
And he was saying, try to shorten some of that up, maybe give multiple actions in a turn or whatever, to try to allow a player to experience the positive payoff of the things they're doing in the game more often so that mm-hmm. they enjoy it more.
Right.
What do you think?
I thought about it afterward, and I thought back to other games I've played, and I feel like he's got a pretty solid point that the anticipation of a really nice turn is almost as much or more fun than actually resolving it and getting to do it. Like, I'm thinking to like stuff like Dominion when I've got a really good hand. When I'm waiting for you and Alphonse and Gary to finish your turns, like, it's like an itchy enjoyment, I guess I would describe it, because I really want to get to my turn and do my thing, but at the same time, I'm enjoying thinking, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to play this, and then this, 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 and it's all going to resolve this way, and it's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
But it's itchy, I guess. I want it to happen. I want to get to that point. You know, you're amped up, you're ready, which is good.
But you don't want the other players' turns to take too long, because it gets to a point where it's just frustrating.
Right. So you want to, so that
it's like, yeah, it's like mom's plug your ears. It's like board game blue balls. It builds for so long that then you're just like, okay, now I'm just angry. Now I just, right, I want to do the thing that I've been planning to do.
So if,
Gary, finish your turn.
So there's an element of planning a smooth curve to that anticipation so that it builds up and releases at the appropriate point.
Yeah.
Whereby you're not going to be, the balls, and I guess I don't know what kind of ball we're talking about here, will be of the appropriate color.
Right.
Right. Not right.
Basketballs. They're supposed to be orange.
Yeah, just huge orange balls. That's what we're talking about.
Isn't that what that means?
Yeah. If you paint a basketball blue, the players can't see it, because this is an unusual fact. Not a lot of people know it. 99% of people who play basketball, who are drawn to play that sport, can't see the color blue at all.
They can't even see anything that is the color blue.
They look up at the sky during the day, and it's just an infinite void, and they're scared.
It is an infinite void.
Yeah, but it's blue in our case. For them, it's a nightmare uncolor.
I want to know how any basketball team with blue jerseys gets dressed.
They have interns to help them.
Interns.
Non-basketball playing interns.
Right.
They get their cities.
Or the 1% of players that can see blue have to end up on those teams.
They get their players' baseball team to come help them. Or their cities, rather. Yeah. But the other thing that I thought about regarding the dopamine cycle and not balls.
Yeah, go on.
Was that it's not a discrete element within a game. It's not like you've got one series of dopamine cycles rising, falling, rising, falling, rising, falling. You've got these individual dopamine cycles of individual turns rising, falling, building, anticipation, resolution, plan, anticipate, resolve. But you've also got overall larger cycles within the game operating over many turns, over like the beginning, early game, mid game, end game. So for example, I've been coming back to Dominion a bunch tonight for reasons that are not clear to me.
Yeah, I have too.
But you might have, at the early part of the game, you're planning over these next couple of turns, I'm going to try to get, you know, a bunch of I'm going to try to build towards having cities. I want to be able to buy cities consistently. That's one card you can get in Dominion. And so now you've got the planning. I want to plan around having to get to the point where I can consistently buy cities. And then you've got the anticipation over those turns, multiple turns where you're in each individual turns, you're also operating on a dopamine cycle. Where you're anticipating getting to the point where you can start to buy cities consistently. And then you've got the resolution of, now I've got enough silver and gold in my deck that I'm going to be able to, on most turns, buy cities. I can start a new plan. I can start a new one. So you've got these multiple layered and of dopamine cycles and cycles of multiple length. And I don't know if physiologically that means you're releasing dopamine in different ways. I don't know the chemistry of that, but just from the way Uwe described it in the model, it layers, though. And then you've got the overall cycle of the game, the planning, I'm going to go for this strategy, the anticipation of executing it over the course of the game and seeing how it works, and the resolution of, did I win or did Gary win?
Yeah.
So I think that's another design to keep in mind, and it's something to keep in mind too, because he was very focused on just narrowing and really shrinking that cycle as tight as you can get it. I think it's worth considering too the larger scale cycles that are happening in the game and how they interlace and overlay with the smaller ones.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very theoretic way to think about it, but I think it's worth considering and pondering. Could you think, are there any other games that have that kind of layer to them other than Dominion, or is it all games that
well,
are going to probably
I think,
see? Or?
I think all games ought to have it. I think Dominion has a very clear structure to it that demonstrates it well, whether mm-hmm. they put that level of thought into it when designing it or not. It's there. I was wondering about our games. He brought that up at Protospiel looking at someone else's game. He never really mentioned it playing Big Man.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder, just thinking about my own experience, if there's anything we do or could do to make it more. So, like, I look forward to my turn on Big Man, but I'm usually not all that prepared for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little prepared for it. I'm ready to do a thing, but unless I have a really good card that I'm, like, sitting on, like, ready, I'm going to play the, you know, when this happens, I'm going to play the cave-in next to Gary, and it's going to ruin his day. Mm-hmm. I don't experience that so much. It's occasional, and they're usually, if you're going to keep using the dopamine cycle terminology, they're usually longer cycles. It's a more gradual wait for the thing to happen. It's usually not I'm really waiting for my next turn. It's usually I'm waiting for in four or five turns when everything lines up to do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know how much we have those shorter cycles. Like, I think the long cycles are good, like you said, and I think the game-wide cycle of am I going to be the one who wins is good, but do we have smaller little incentives in the game that are interesting enough to produce that sort of reaction?
Yeah, there's definitely those mid-length cycles, and the long cycle of is always there because you're playing a game. I find in Big Man on my turn, I usually have an idea of which card I want to play, you know, as part of the dungeon, and which card I want to grab as treasure. I don't know. I guess I've not noticed that not being prepared for it so much, but maybe I approach it a little bit differently. But it's not a problem I've run into. Myself,
you're saying you do notice those in the short. Looking forward to the
turn? I look forward to my turn on Big Man. I'm always waiting for it. I'm usually constantly on you guys' turn, thumbing through my hand, going reminding myself of what cards I've got, and thinking what if I play, and pondering what I want to play, which is the anticipation phase.
I think I agree. I'm not saying I don't look forward to my next turn. I definitely do, but I don't feel the same excitement for my turn that I do in Dominion.
It's not like you've got
and I don't know that I'm not excited for my turn. I think honestly it's more that there's more going on in other players' turns that is interesting in our game than there is in Dominion.
Well, Dominion's a pretty low player interaction game, it's true.
Yeah.
Unless you're playing with militias because you're a monster.
Or witches or whatever.
Yeah, you're just a villain.
Yep. I learned about the word villain the other day on another podcast.
I was literally just about to bring this up.
Oh, really?
Yeah, go ahead. Tell the thing.
I frankly zoned out partially through this description, so I might get something wrong, but the origin of the word villain was a person who works at a villa.
At a villa, yeah, and they're like a peasant.
Yeah, and so it moved from person, like basically not even innkeeper, but like someone who works there.
Mm-hmm.
And the progression was somewhere along the lines of, like, innkeeper to peasant to sort of general rabble to sort of a more brigand, like, you know, highwayman-type rascal. So it got progressively more negative. And at the point it is today, a lot of people just use villain to mean bad guy. But villain now very specifically means, it's a literary term, meaning a bad guy who basically sets himself up to be overcome by the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And that came from a person who works at a villa.
Yeah, yeah.
Where did you hear about
it? I read about it somewhere on the internet.
I heard it on the Good Job Brain podcast, which is fantastic, and you should check it out. They're on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, and RSS. Good Job Brain.
Good Job Brain. Good Job Brain.
Yep.
You can't see it because this is a podcast, but I'm patting my head right now.
I would say we could have video, but no one wants that.
No, nobody wants that.
No one wants that.
Well, I mean, it could be good, except that when you talk, swarms of angry bees come out.
Well, I think that's the part that people might find the most interesting. Now, a live studio audience would be a real problem.
That would be, yeah.
As they were stung to death by angry hornets.
Yes. And my face is just a melting mass of writhing dog tentacles, so nobody wants that.
Dog tentacles, yeah. If you've ever seen Indiana Jones, where the guy's face melts. It's nothing like that, but similarly gross.
So we probably won't be doing video anytime
nope,
soon.
Nope.
Hilariously enough, except for Uva, who we
send a video to. We're so sorry.
yeah, it's bad.
Well, you got anything else about the dopamine cycle?
Not at the moment. It's an interesting topic, though, and it's an interesting way of thinking about... It's actually an interesting way of thinking about a lot of things, honestly. You know, you're thinking about... You know, I do, in my professional life, training and instructional design and teaching people how to do stuff, and you kind of wonder about that. Can you integrate that into what you're doing so that you've got, essentially you're getting your students and learners high on dopamine in their brain so that they're more receptive to the message you're trying to push on them?
Well, are your students generally seated while you're teaching?
Yeah.
So I would recommend a system of tiny needles in their chairs.
Mm-hmm.
That would just, whenever you feel like you've done something worthy of them enjoying or like something that they should learn, mm-hmm. you should have a button on your podium that just pokes them all in the butt and with a little needle and injects some dopamine.
Just straight dopamine.
Yeah,
right into their buttock.
Right into their butt. And then their butts will be happy at the very least, which is a start.
Well, but, you know, there's the old Polish saying, if the butt is happy, the mind is happy.
That sounds made up.
I don't think... No, the Poles don't say that at all.
No, because they don't even speak English, that was, like, as a native language.
That was slanderous to Polish people everywhere.
Well, if you want to know more about the dopamine cycle, there are quite a few articles and interviews out there from Uwe Eichert of Academy Games.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find them on the internet by searching for his name, which we've posted before and we'll post again in the show notes. You have anything else to add before we wrap it up?
No, I think I'm good.
Coolio. Then he's a rapper. Coolio.
Is he the same rapper? Probably. Is he the same or different from LL Cool J?
Those are different. You know that LL Cool J, in fact...
I'm so excited right now.
It's short for Ladies Love Cool, and I forget what the J stands for. It might be just J, like how the J in Homer J. Simpson is short for J. I want to say it's Jake, but that sounds totally wrong.
Hold on, we gotta look this up.
We're looking. It's important stuff here, you guys.
LL Cool J. James Todd Smith.
James. Ladies Love Cool James.
Hold on. Better known as LL Cool J, short for Ladies Love Cool James, is an American rapper, entrepreneur, and actor. He is known for pioneering hip-hop tracks such as I Can't Live Without My Radio, I'm Bad, The Boomin' System, Rock the Bells, and Mama Said Knock You Out, as well as romantic ballads such as Doin' It, I Need Love, Around the Way Girl, and Hey Lover.
Ladies love Cool James.
Ladies do love Cool James.
If you want to tell us how much you love Cool James, you can hit us up on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
You can send us an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Or you could leave a comment on the website at www.mildlyalarming.com or in the comment section on Stitcher or iTunes, where you have left us a 5-star review and mentioned how much you love Cool James.
You can just rap your comment and it will drift on the ether to us. The rap ether.
Reether. See you next week.
Goodbye. Hey there, everybody. I'm Hugh Carpslap from Carpslap Auto Supply, the only auto parts store in the tri-state area where I will personally belt you across the face with a dead carp. I am aptly named, thickly armed, and possessed of an ice chest full of dead fish that I badly want to wield like a medieval bludgeon upon your rosy cheeks. Come on down to my shop and take a fish to the head. Men and women, children and pets, nobody gets out of the Carpslap Auto Supply without a flipper-shaped mark across their face. And you can buy a carburetor or whatever. Come on down and see us today at Carpslap Auto Supply. I'll hit you with a fish!